Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another session where we're going to be talking a little bit more about the contingency argument for God's existence. Now, in this series, the focus has been on the contingency argument, or different types of contingency arguments. As we know, there are other arguments for God's existence. But before we continue, let's review the proposition of the contingency argument on the first slide. So it's written here, so I'm going to read it out. There cannot be a world, the proposition goes, with only dependent things, without reference to an independent thing, as dependent things cannot continue existing on their own. Existence is only explicable with reference to an independent existence. This is because impossible existence do not exist by logical necessity, and dependent existence cannot self-generate and or self-maintain. So let's focus on that last bit here. Dependent existences cannot self-generate and or self-maintain. There's two options with this proposition. Either that the interlocutor accepts it and agrees with it, or that the interlocutor disagrees with it. So if you say to the interlocutor, dependent things cannot self-generate and or self-maintain, they can either say, yes, they can, and you're wrong, or they can say, yeah, you're right, they cannot, and you're right. There's no third option there. It's exhaustible. So if I were to put this into practice, or if I were to give an example of this, for example, if I were to say the universe cannot self-generate and or self-maintain. If the interlocutor says, yes, it can, so then he's disagreed with me. If he says, no, you're right, it cannot, then they are in agreement with me. Yeah. If I say a multiverse, an infinite multiverse, you've got two options. Either an infinite multiverse can not self-generate or self-maintain, or it can self-generate or self-maintain. So to put this in more simple terms, the universe is either dependent or independent. The multiverse is either dependent or independent. There's no other option here. Either is dependent or independent. Now, how have we defined dependence? What is the definition of dependency?
Something that can't self-generate and can be destructible. It's something that's destructible, and something that's that can't generate on its own. Something that's reliant on others for existence.
Yes. This part here for sure. Something which relies on something else for its existence. That's the definition of dependency. Now, who remembers the distinction between dependency and causation? What is causation?
Causation is bringing something into existence. Dependent thing, existence requires something else to continually exist, not only to come into existence.
Right, great. Give me an example of something which is caused into existence and something which...
Right, yeah, I think we use the example of a child coming, being born. So the father and mother is causing the child to exist, but the child doesn't depend on their parents to exist.
So in other words, the parents can die and the father and mother can still... the child can still live on.
Exist, yeah.
Great, so now we have differentiated causation from dependency. And since we are talking here about dependency, we are not talking necessarily about causation. We are talking about dependency. And so we say that, okay, well, the universe is either dependent or is independent. This phone is either dependent or independent. This phone. Now, let's say this phone is either dependent or independent in terms of being powered. Now, I know that my phone requires a charger. I'm sure yours do as well, unless someone here has some new technology there. But this is the truth. Now, in this case, the phone is what? Is it dependent or independent?
Dependent.
It's dependent, right? The same thing about us. We are dependent. The human being is dependent. Now, how do we know that the human being is dependent?
For our continual existence, like, we rely on other things. So things like food, water, sleep. Yeah.
Yes. That's one way of finding out that we rely on other things. That's true. another thing is that, are we made up of limited or unlimited number of things?
Yeah, we're made up of a limited number of things, so we rely on these parts to make us as a whole being.
Great, and so if someone were to say that the universe or that the multiverse was independent, what would you say?
The universe is dependent because it is made up of parts and it relies on these parts to be the universe.
Okay, good. What else would you say?
That it could be added to and deducted from.
Yeah, that shows its limitations, absolutely. Anything that is susceptible to addition or subtraction is limited by necessity. What else can you say?
At any given moment, it's conceivable that the universe could be in some other way.
Yeah, brilliant, fantastic. So in other words, a universe or a multiverse cannot be what?
Necessary existence.
It can't be the necessary existence, it can't be independent. So we said the universe is either dependent or independent. Now if they say it's independent, the first thing I would point out is that they don't see an impossibility of an independent being or thing or entity into creation. So in other words, if they say, well, the universe is independent, or that the multiverse is independent, what they've fathomed is that there can be such a thing as an independent being. And this is what is independent? Independent is, well, how do you define independent?
Something that don't depend on nothing. Something that don't depend on anything.
Yeah, it doesn't depend on anything. You can call it self-sufficient. We're talking about self-sufficiency. So it doesn't depend on anything. Everything depends upon it, but it depends upon nothing. So if you can conceive or fathom a world where that can be the case, already you've left what? You can no longer call yourself something, which is what? An atheist. An atheist doesn't believe in this. You know, this is something an atheist can't believe. So you've got two things. The universe / the infinite multiverse, or a finite multiverse, any of those categories there, or positions, they can either be dependent or independent. Now we've shown why they can't be independent. So what do we need as something which is independent? If something without something with parts and which is limited and which relies on something else for its existence can't be independent, what qualities must something which is independent have?
Have no parts.
No parts. Yeah.
Have no beginning.
Have no beginning. Yeah. So pre-eternality. Yeah.
No end.
Yeah. It's supposed to eternal as well. Yes.
Depend on nothing.
Yes. So self-sufficient.
Self-sufficient.
Yeah. Good. This is correct. Now, if someone admits to this, then they've already believed. That's it. That's we have reached the point of agreement. So that's the first thing. Now, these what I'm about to put forward to you today are the five most common objections to this line of argumentation. The first is the fallacy of composition. Now we've covered this already, but we'll cover it again. Someone will say, well, just because inside of the universe there's causation, there's dependency, it doesn't mean that the universe itself is dependent and or that the universe itself is caused. For example, an elephant is very big, but it's made up of very small pieces. Just because the elephant is made up of small pieces, we can't conclude that the elephant is small. Now, what's the response to this that we've covered?
It's made up of pieces.
It's made up of pieces, so what?
So it depends on the pieces.
Right, so this is good, right? If you take out or put in pieces into something, this already indicates this finitude or limitation. Okay, and all we're trying to prove is that something which is susceptible to addition or subtraction is not independent. That's all we have to prove. That's the first thing. The second thing is what?
Something that can be rearranged, by definition, can't be a necessary existence because it's possible to conceive it in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So the universe can be rearranged in another way. Therefore, it's conceivable that it can be another universe. You know, this is not a fixer. So the composition fallacy is more effective with the Kalam cosmological argument. it's not as effective with the contingency argument, especially considering the ontological component. Because the ontological component, and what do we mean by ontology?
Something that's in the mind?
Yeah, something which we conceive in the mind rather than something which is... the ontological component is that we can conceive and conceptualize something some other way. And so the universe can be conceptualized, and therefore the universe is not what? Necessary, correct? So the ontological aspect of this response is not available in the same terms in a cause-based argument, which makes the contingency argument in this way more able to ward off the refutation or the counterattacks of the atheist detractor. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, so we talked about the fallacy of composition here. It's very important that we know something. When we use the word part, what we mean and what we don't mean. Now, there is a study, we've spoke about it before, I'm not sure if anyone remembers. It starts with an M, which talks about parts and wholes. What is it called?
Myriology.
So, myriology is a study of parts and wholes. It's a sub-branch of logic. And the word part has more than one definition. As you can see, a part can mean something which is attached, detached, cognitively or functionally salient, arbitrarily demarcated, self-connected, homogeneous, gerrymandered, material, immaterial, extended or unextended, or spatial or temporal. Now, we're not meaning all these terms when we say part. We are just meaning when we say parts that something cannot be independent if it has parts. It's something which can be attached or detached. This is all we're talking about when we say part. Because this is important theologically that we narrow our definition of parts. Because then someone will say, well, what you mean by part is an attribute. And therefore you believe in a God with 99, it's not actually 99, but at least 99 attributes, right? That is it's unjustifiable. So we say, no, we don't mean that when we mean parts. We mean something which can be taken out and put in, like this straw. I don't know, if I cut this thing up right now, if I, you know, this thing right here, you know, it's made up of different parts. As you can see, it can be disassembled, right? The phone. All of these things are made up of attachable or detachable parts. Now, someone might still have objection with this, but from an Islamic perspective, we can never, you know, just theologically, we can never say God has parts. That's impossible. This is not an issue. So, that is the first thing. That's what we're talking about. The fallacy of composition, how to solve the fallacy of composition. The strongest argument or counter-argument is an ontological one. Okay, because there's no way out. As we said before with the fallacy of composition, the issue is that both atheists and theists don't know what the whole looks like. So we gave this example a few times, I'll give it again. If I say that a wall is made up of small bricks, it doesn't mean that the wall is small. But if the wall is made up of red bricks, it can mean that the wall is red. So sometimes the part can have a connection with the whole, and sometimes the part will not have a connection with the whole. Now, how do we know if the universe does have it, or is caused, for instance, yeah? We have to know the whole. Now, no one has seen or has an encompassing view of the universe as a whole. So, if we were to have a strictly cause-based argument, this means gridlock. That's what this actually means. So, if I were to say to you, everything that begins to exist has a cause, the universe began to exist, and therefore the universe had a cause. The composition argument is the strongest counter-argument to this, because someone can say, well, you don't know if you're committing the fallacy of composition or not. Because just as the universe has causes inside of it, it doesn't mean that the universe itself has a cause. Just like you can have an elephant made up of small pieces, but the elephant itself can be big. So there's a disparate, you know, thing between the whole and the part. And what we say in return is, well, this applies more to a cause-based argument than a contingency argument, which has ontological traits. So if we say, well, it can be conceived in another way, and therefore it's contingent, it's not necessary, it can't be independent, it's finished. It's done. There's no counter-argument to that counter-argument. So it becomes checkmate. And at this point, we can proceed. Now, the second thing that we can talk about is infinite regress. Now, what do you remember is different about the contingency argument to the, say, the Kalam argument of Al-Ghazali that is mentioned by William Lane Craig? What's different in terms of the way we conceptualize, or Avicenna, for example, conceptualizes infinity? Does he have, what's his views on infinity?
He allows it to exist. Like, he says that even if we do suppose we have like infinite universes, then this is fine.
Yes, what does he not allow?
If the reading is a quasi.
That's the one, yeah. Right? So, just like Aristotle, Avicenna differentiates between an infinite regress of things and an infinite regress of causes. What other thinker actually does the same thing, interestingly, from Islamic theology? Ibn Taymiyyah, actually. And we know that because of Hawadith La Awwala Laha, that God is perpetually creating into the past. And this is something he does believe, but he doesn't believe that the universe is eternal. This is false. It's Ash'ari propaganda. They say that, you know, Ibn Taymiyyah believes the same thing as Ibn Sina, which is false. It's absolutely wrong, incorrect. Ibn Sina believes that the universe is eternal, just like Aristotle believed that. Ibn Taymiyyah doesn't believe that. He believed that there was something before the universe, and God created something before that, and something before that, and that each of those individual things had a beginning.
What did he base that on?
He based it on Allah's name, Al-Khalaq, that he is the perpetual creator. Because Allah is called Al-Khaliq in the Quran, but he's also called Al-Khalaq, which means he continually creates. So he said if this name was to be realized, then he had to be creating perpetually into the past. Now this is an aberrational view. It is an aberrational view. If you look at all of the people that have spoken about this, he's not like he's representing a clear position of the Salaf. And this might be controversial to some people. I know it will be, but he's not. Because if you go back to the companions and the Salaf, and they seem to indicate that there was something that began the creation. It's mentioned Nun Mukhalim wa Yasturun, you know, the hadith, the ayah, the tafsir of this is very clear. Either the pen was the first thing to be created. What is awwal man khuliq? Is it the water, the pen, the arsh, whatever? This is a theological discussion. But on strictly logical grounds, he doesn't see any issues with there being God creating perpetually into the past like that. And he has a good argument. He says, well, you guys believe in heaven and hell. And heaven and hell, this is a theological point. Heaven and hell, is there going to be, if you want things infinitely and perpetually into the future, he says, is there any issue with that? He says, there's no issue with that. You believe in it, in fact. خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا أَبَدًا. You're going to be in there forever. He said, therefore, if there can be a perpetual creation into the future, there's no... That doesn't differentiate, doesn't, yani, there's no difference between that and a perpetual creation to the past. He said they're epistemologically similar. So, logically, if you're saying it's impossible, it's muhal aqlan, then you have to drop the idea that there can be an infinite level of created things into the future. So, this is his argument. I mean, once again, you can have your own views on it. I don't care too much about it, but. What's interesting for us on this point is, if he allows it logically, then someone, an atheist, saying we believe in an infinite multiverse, according to this kind of line of reasoning, there's no issue at all. Because atheists use an infinite multiverse as a substitute for God. But according to many opinions within Islam, you can have an infinite multiverse, but God is the one who is sustaining all of it.
Is that purely theoretical when they say multiverse? Because there's no proof for any, right?
Yes, yeah, of course.
So
yeah.
It's just a mathematical concept. So obviously.
Oh yeah, physics specialist, please tell us more.
So basically, all of theoretical physics is math. So by definition, it doesn't need to have any physical observation for you to actually come up to a conclusion. It's basically math and derivations of math, and you just make things up to fix equation. Just say that you have a gap in a certain equation. You can create your own sort of formula to fit that equation to solve it. And the solution that they come up with is a multiverse, but there are like 100 different more solutions that can come up. But once again, that's just math. You can basically do math to come up with any conclusion that you want to.
And from your studies at university, what kind of prominent theories of the multiverse are there? Are there theories that indicate limited multiverse, or is it more about, or do they actually explicitly talk about infinite multiverses? What kind of things do we have out there?
It's mainly based on the quantum phenomena of observation.
Right.
That every observation is going to result in two different things in the quantum realm. So as soon as you make an observation, it's no longer the same system. And what they do that to explain that, all they say is that, okay, as soon as you make an observation, another multiverse starts where you make the other observation. So it just splits up into more and more and more and more pieces.
Ad infinitum.
Exactly.
Right. So this is exactly what we're talking about. Because they will use this as a substitute for God. Like in the theological space, or in the space of theist versus atheist debates. And what will be the response? We'll say, what is it all dependent on? We go back to our main point. Because, you know, you've got all of these observations that you're making, but you've got all these, let's assume that you have a realist framework here. You have all of these multiverses, and there's actual infinity. We're not even doubting that there's an infinity. We're not doing Al-Ghazali's work of cancelling an infinity. We're saying, let there be an infinity. And let there be an infinite number of multiverses. But then we go back to, what question? What's the question? If they say, if someone comes to you...
Huh? Yes, either going to be dependent or independent.
Yeah. And why can it not be independent?
Because if you have infinite multiverses, then it's still dependent because it's made up of parts.
And?
And you can conceive of it in another way.
Beautiful.
And you can subtract and
There you have it. Yeah. And let's pause and emphasize the point on conceive of it in another way. What do we mean by this? Give me an example of something you can't conceive of in another way. A fact of some sorts.
2 plus 2.
Yeah?
2 plus 2.
2 plus 2 equals 4.
Yeah.
So it's a necessary fact.
Yeah.
You're right, great. So the infinite multiverse, what makes it different from this necessary fact?
You can conceive it like in an infinite universe that's linear, for example, or infinite universe that is circular. That depends on the. So you have A created B, B created C, and then you have.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be infinite, right?
No.
That would be finite. If it's a circular in the way you've described, I know you're getting at, but let's stick with infinite. So you're on the right tracks. If it's an infinite multiverse, it can be conceived of in another way. What do we mean by that? Anybody?
Yeah, you could rearrange it. Also in abstraction, we can conceive that it could be rearranged in a different way.
Great. Give me an example. Let's say we've got, for the sake of argument, we've got a multiverse. Obviously, this is not how it works in physics. But let's just say universe 1, universe 2, universe 3, ad infinitum.
Right.
How would that be conceived of in another way?
So let's say universe 1 cause universe 2 and universe 2 cause universe 3.
Subtracting any idea of causation.
Right.
You could have one universe where, but like this universe, right? And then you can have another universe where maybe everyone has, heads on their feet, mm-hmm. right? You can conceive of like any different kind of thing. But the fact that you can conceive of it, right? That shows that it is contingent, so it's not necessary.
That's one way of doing it. So you can say, like Al-Ghazali, he said, you can conceive of the planets rotating, going anti-clockwise. You can conceive of them going clockwise. That's conceptually possible. But there's something else which you mentioned, Tariq, in the beginning, about destructibility and something about generation and destructibility. There are things which did not exist in the universe, which now do exist.
Yeah, yeah.
me and you are examples of that. And if they say, well, in energy, it always existed. We're not talking about energy, we're talking about something else, which is what? Starts with F. Form.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Form. So forms of things change. That indicates that thing is potential and it's not actual. Remember this? And if something is potential, it can't be independent. You see? And so you can do this in many different ways. But the multiverse cannot be an actual independent thing. You see what we're doing here, yeah? But if they say, well, we believe in an infinite multiverse, and that's a substitute for God, then we show them, we go back to what we said before, it's either dependent or independent. If they say it's independent, you show them that that disqualifies them from atheism, but then you go on to show that actually it's argumentum ad absurdum. You show them that if you can't have that, because actually it's made up of limited parts, which many of which can be, or if not all of which, can be conceived of as being removed or not in existence. Because a necessary existence is something which, is, if it was removed, absurdities would occur. But by the removal of something which is a contingent existence from the universe, no absurdities would occur at all. It doesn't challenge existence to remove something possible and contingent or dependent from it. It doesn't challenge the notion of existence in any way. In fact, this is what Ibn Sina says. He says, and by the way, this point here is what Aviraz, he said you shouldn't mention, just to let you know, Ibn Rushd. He said, just stick to the idea that things are destructible and generatable. And if they have susceptibility for this, then, but, you know, you can use whatever you like. This is what's out there. Now, so we've just mentioned two of probably the most important interrogations. The third one is pretty pathetic indeed, which is what Bertrand Russell said, one of the forerunners of atheism, intellectual atheism, in the last 100 years. And he was asked about these kinds of things. And you know what he said? He said, the universe just is. I have a child. I have 3 children, as you know. Well, I have a 3-year-old child. Sometimes when she does something and I ask her, why do you do that? Yeah, she looks at me and she says one word. She says, because. And I sat with her one time, and I sat with the boy as well, the 5-year-old, and I explained to them that this is no justification at all. And I warned them, wallahi, this is a true story. I said, if you take this level of justification into your adult life, people will make a mockery out of you. This is the truth. We don't accept this level of justification for any other thing. Yet when it comes to the universe, it becomes somehow shortlisted as one of the major objections, intellectual objections, by one of the greatest atheistic minds, which is Bertrand Russell. Wallahi, this is no joke. This is what they say. This is what he said. You can check this yourself. He said, the universe just is. It seems like a child speaking, not an intellectual. But somehow atheists latch onto this as if some great word has been spoken by a noble prophet. It's worthy of reprimand, I say. And Richard Swinburne, who's notable Christian theologian and intellectual, he puts it in maybe a bit more academic language than I just used. He said, the objection fails to make any crucial distinction between the universe and other objects, and so it fails in its attempt to prevent, at the outset, a rational inquiry into the issue of whether the universe has some origin outside of itself. In other words, he is saying you are specializing, or if you like, discriminating. You're using discriminatory language with the universe that you would not use with anything else in existence. Why is the universe? The universe just is. You wouldn't allow that level of explanation for any other question that you may be asked. And so it's no objection at all. It's not what, yeah.
For the necessary being, for God in this case.
No, but remember, we've argued for the necessary being using contingency.
No, but if you said God just is.
We don't just say he just is.
Yeah.
We say that it's a necessary conclusion. Yeah. So what we don't say, Allah just is. That's not what we're saying. We can't say, if we said Allah just is, they would not take us seriously.
But like, my point is, so for the universe we can't use it because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Same like, but for God you could say he just is.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be wrong. You could say that, but yeah, it's no explanation at all if you said that.
Okay.
You would not be proving anything by saying he just is. So, okay, well, you know, he just isn't. You know, someone can just, you know, anyone can, especially when it's not, you know, empirically verifiable, as they would understand. That's the main thing. So, that's why we are using argumentation. We're not saying God just is. You can't just say that, because then there's no point. There is no discussion after that. You are saying, I don't want to talk about it when you say that. Like my child.
That's what they say.
It's like, I don't want to talk about it. Like my, when she says, why did you drop that, you know, coffee that she dropped yesterday or 2 days ago, whenever it was, but she also dropped it before. Or whatever she does, she spilled something, you know, the child. She's two actually, she's not even three yet. Why'd you do it? Because. Give me a reason. There's no reason. So it's not something which requires, don't always think you need to respond. There's nothing here to respond to. That person is failing to engage. Okay, so this is unfortunately, it's the third most commonly cited thing I've seen, probably in this discussion. A fourth thing is retrocausality. I'm not sure if you've heard of this. Have you heard of the grandfather paradox?
You go back in time and kill your own grandfather.
Yeah, please tell us, yeah.
Well, it's not like a physics concept, it's just like a thought experiment.
Yeah, go ahead.
But basically, if you go back in time, which is also, you know, goes against physics, but if you do somehow go back in time and you kill your own grandfather, and this is before you're born, so your grandfather's, let's say, 15 years old, and you go back and you kill your own grandfather, well, then how did you go back in time to kill your own grandfather if your grandfather's dead? How are you alive to go back and kill him? That's basically the grandfather paradox.
Absolutely. And you tell us more about this, because this is something which, in the quantum world, it's good that we have you today, this guy. But in the quantum world, they talk about retrocausality, and I've seen it being used axiomatically, like as an axiom rather than as a discovered thing. To what extent is this operationalized in quantum physics?
So, once again, the thing about quantum physics is, you know, the main problem with quantum mechanics, when you compare it to classical mechanics, is that when you do go down to things that are extremely, extremely small, things don't work the way that they do in classical physics. And the main issue with quantum mechanics is that is the issue of observation, that you can't really observe something and find out its velocity and momentum at the exact same time. You can either find out one, but then the accuracy of the other is going to reduce. You can find out the other, but the accuracy of that is going to reduce. And what happens is, a system, before you observe that system, before you make any measurement in the system, it's going to be a certain way. As soon as you make that observation, it's going to give you some other answer. So it's not going to be what it was before you made the observation.
Like the double split experiment.
Exactly. Well, the double slit experiment is like possibly the best experiment to have ever been done in quantum mechanics. Even though it doesn't explain anything, but it just shows you the nature of quantum mechanics. So what they just do at that point is just start making axioms about quantum mechanics, and they say, okay, this is how it is. We can't really understand the whys, but this is what it seems to be happening. We're not going to question the whys. We're going to make these the axioms, and we're just going to go on and solve the math to figure out more things.
Yes, and I have seen like I've said, retrocausality being used as an axiom in quantum physics. Thank you, that contribution is very, very useful. But what we would say at this point, remember, we're making the argument from dependency, a contingency, not necessarily an argument from causation. We would say what? There's a difference between causality and what? Dependence. So, do you know, let's go back to the grandfather paradox. The grandfather paradox, the guy is going back in time, killing his own grandfather, which is paradoxical because he wouldn't be able to do that had he been what he is. But we said dependency is defined as something needing something else in order to rely on it. And this is continual, whereas causation is not continual. So if you say that the grandfather caused the grandson, that's one thing. But if we say he depends on him, that's another. And now, which means that there can be no conceivable moment where if A doesn't exist, B does exist. Does that make sense? With causation, it's conceivable that if A doesn't exist, B, which it caused, can exist. But with dependency, that's impossible. And if you say it is possible, then you're saying it's independent. We go back to square one. For example, if we say the universe was caused by itself, أَمْ خُلِقُوا مِنْ غَيْرِ شَيْءٍ أَمْ هُمُ الْخَالِقُونَ, the Quranic question, was it created by itself? Was it created by nothing? Or were they themselves the creators of themselves? Was the universe created from nothing? We're going to come to that. It's impossible, right? Even Lawrence Krauss tells us that. Or was it itself the creator of itself? Was the universe, did it create itself? So they go with the second one, that the universe created itself. They answer in the positive. Some have tried it. It's not popular in academia, but it's popular on YouTube and these kind of things, stuff like that. So we say, fine, for the sake of argument, no problem. The universe created itself. There you have it, yeah? However, this is not the problem. The problem is that universe, it's not just that it had to cause itself, is that it had to keep itself in existence and maintain itself and sustain itself. And if it does that, then it's independent. And if it's independent, then once again we go back to our main question. You see how powerful the thing about dependence and independence thing? Because if you say that the universe is independent, then the definition of independent is it depends upon itself. That's what the definition of dependent is. So if you're saying it's always requiring only itself in order to be maintained, that is exactly how you define God. It's only dependent on itself. And so the retrocausality thing, there's actually no discussion whatsoever when it comes to dependence. Because if the moment you say something depends on itself, you're saying it's independent. And the moment you're saying it's independent, you've lost out on being an atheist. It's a disqualifier of atheism.
How is that disqualifier of atheism? Because is an atheist just not believing in God? Like not necessarily not believing in a independent, or think something being independent.
So the definition of an atheist, there's two major definitions. But let's say it's the lacking of existence, a lacking of belief. No, you lack belief in the existence of God. Now we have to ask the question, what is the minimum requirement for a God to be a God? Now the atheist has no right to tell us what the word God means. The minimum requirement is a deistic explanation of God. Then after that, classical theism, and after that, theism. A deistic explanation is that something which brings about and or explains the universe, something like this. Otherwise, what is God then? What are we talking about here? We must be talking about something which brought about what we have and which everything that we have depends on. That is the minimum deistic requirement. Because there's another word. The other word is called deism. You can't be an atheist deist. Otherwise, the word deist loses its value. And now we're talking about semantics. But it's impossible to be someone who lacks belief in God, but believes in a kind of deistic conception of God. Then the two words are your. Then in that case, what they're saying is that they're synonyms. They're not synonyms, though. That's, if they were synonyms, there'd be thesaurusly kind of, you go into thesaurus and you'll find that the word is, it's not a synonym. So if they try and redefine what it is to be an atheist, then that's capitulation. That means you've admitted that now you have to redefine what it means to be an atheist so you can maintain your label.
Isn't that what usually happens when somebody talks about someone's atheism? They're like, no, actually I'm an agnostic atheist, or actually I'm this kind of an
atheist. But this argument takes them out of agnosticism as well. Mm. It brings them into deism, at least a deism. So you can't be agnostic from gnostos, I don't know, like the idea that you don't know whether there's a God or not. You know, but once again, if you subscribe to a deistic conception of God, you can no longer say you don't know. So this is the power of this argument. It takes them out of agnosticism, and it takes them out of atheism. They can't have both. They can't say there's something which is independent, which everything depends upon, and it depends upon nothing, and say, well, actually, I'm agnostic. Because you've just nullified your agnosticism. You're no longer agnostic, and you're no longer atheist. The minimum you can say is you're a deist. That's the minimum. Or a classical theist. But you can't say you can no longer say you're an atheist or an agnostic. Now that becomes, now you're playing around with language. And by the way, according to all the definitions, now you have to change the dictionaries. Now you have to go and change the peer-reviewed stuff. Now you have to, you know. So That's the objection number four, which is retrocausality. Well, let's do the fifth objection first, and then come in. The fifth objection is something from nothing. Now, this is no objection at all. Because even the one who said, I believe in something from nothing, you can read it yourself, I'm not going to read his whole thing out, because it's a waste of time. But basically, his understanding of nothing is not nothing. Krauss. This is not something which people were talking about, and this is not a serious theory that something can come from nothing. And so we've established that the five major objections are easy to kind of explain. These are the five major objections, by the way, to this kind of argument. What we're going to do now is we can do some role playing, okay? So we'll start with, so we'll divide the class into people atheist and agnostic and then theist, and we'll see what we can do. But with this particular session, we have concluded, and hopefully in the next session we'll go into more details on these issues. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.